Okay, so let me start. It's in the nature of the topic that I will say hardly anything about virtually everything, but I was asked to give a review, and that's what you're going to get, I think. So I've restricted myself largely to high redshift for reasons that have become obvious. I leave the stuff on the other machine. I hope you can see this. That's a cartoon of the variant distribution of actually, these are most of the results I'll talk about. Starting on top with omega variant value from the deuterium to hydrogen ratio. This is actually David Teitler's value. Then the lambda alpha forest, which is one of the main results of the past decade in this subject, I guess. The lambda alpha forest contains most of the baryons, so it's very likely to contain them. Then there's a metal enriched phase, which is another interesting topic that will be talked more about in the afternoon. And further down at about 10% of the baryon level are the damped lambda alpha systems. Their abundance or their omega content is actually best constrained in spite of the seemingly large error bars, but it's a logarithmic plot. Then there are stars, which contain, oops, here we are. Try to draw a map of the speaker. It's actually, here's Jerry Ostrich on his own cloud talking about the variables of the baryons at low redshift, which is actually a more interesting topic and not really universally agreed upon. Here is the rest of you. Sorry, it's a bit generalizing, but the stars, of course, the stars, of course, go down with redshift. I haven't drawn this because it's highly uncertain. Okay, so I will talk a little bit about how did the baryons get there, where they are, where we think they are. What's the relevance of the different baryonic reservoirs for galaxy formation? Okay, the observation material is exclusively quasar absorption spectra because of the low density of the matter involved. This is a Keck spectrum taken in collaboration with Wall, Sargent, and Tombalo. You see, this is quite a typical quasar, the broad lambda alpha emission line, the lambda alpha forest, the damped lambda alpha system here that has several metal components. Redward of the lambda alpha emission line. And the metal lines invariably have a lot of structure. This is a carbon 4 system. You see the doublet structure repeating itself on the right with a velocity spread that is not unusual, 520 kilometers per second, which is very hard to explain if this is a motion in a galactic potential well, for example. Okay, so what are the lambda alpha forest lines? These are three simulated lines that illustrate the column density range that you can observe with unsaturated lines. They correspond typically to mean densities of ranging from about mean overdensities from 15 to less than 1 if you're looking against an underdense region. So you can see underdense regions in the universe in absorption. Where are the baryons at high redshift? This is a convoluted history. I think I can say with some justification. Before 1990, the general view was that they're actually in galaxies or in damped lambda alpha systems. And that makes sense if you have monolithic collapse. All the baryons have fallen into the galaxies. But this result was basically known already, that damped lambda alpha systems would have only about 10% of the mass of the standard nucleosynthesis baryon value. And this is actually something that is not easy to explain in monolithic collapse. And the explanation came only through hierarchical structure formation where the deposition of baryons in galaxies is very inefficient. Okay, then in 1981, there was actually the first paper I think that claimed that you can hide a lot of baryons in the lambda alpha forest. This was pre-CDM, so they had huge self-gravitating clouds. That didn't become very popular for various reasons. Then the first who actually established that the fluctuations in CDM mass power spectrum can produce a lambda alpha forest was B, another paper that was widely ignored, I think. And implicitly, it was clear that you would need a lot of baryons in order to produce any detectable absorption. Then the various groups in the early 90s pointed out that you can actually accommodate most baryons in CDM mini halos. This was, again, not universally accepted. One of the co-authors of this paper actually wanted to have his conclusion out of the paper because he didn't believe it. And I know of at least one other paper that was rejected that made it had a similar conclusion. And now you see how the phrasing changes. Now most variants need to be in the IgM. This was a requirement that became obvious when people began to do cosmological hydro simulations. I've actually I've forgotten Watsley and Bond, so I should have added it. And this is now the new paradigm, or depending on your view, the new dogma. Okay, I have to put up at least one plot. This is a contour plot of 100 megaparsec box of Renyu Chen, and the contours are at an overdensity of 3. So this is an absorption line that has an optical depth of roughly 1. You remember, it's a relatively strong alpha forest absorption line. So you can imagine that the covering factor is very high, that through any line of sight through this box will produce, on the average, more than one alpha forest line. If you go to higher resolution, higher spatial resolution, you see the picture changes somewhat. This is from Matthias Steinmetz's SPH simulation, a box that's only about 1% as long as the previous one. And I've introduced some perverse color code here that actually rises. It becomes blacker with increasing density, and then it drops again. What I've done here is I've tried to denote the column density range, or the column density contours where most of the variants appear to sit. This is in the range from about 10 to the 14 to 10 to the 15 and a half. So most of the variants in the universe are actually in this diffuse matter. They're not in the higher column density ranges. So what you see as white with the black dots in the middle are Lyman limit systems with damped Lyman alpha systems in them. And that's about 10 to 20% of the variant fraction. So most of the variants are in low and intermediate column density gas. The other interesting finding, one of the first Keck results, was that the same column density range is actually widely metal enriched at a low level, but with a relatively large covering factor. The result that various people present here in the room have obtained, Kaui et al., Teitel et al., and Walter Argent's group. Okay, now running lines of sight through these simulations, you can try to understand the physical parameters of the Lyman alpha forest. I don't want to go into this. David Weinberg is probably talking about this with more detail and with more authority also. But here's an example of a line of sight run through this the previous Chen et al. Box, and underneath the density field in green, the temperature field in red, and you see there is a relatively close correspondence between density peaks and absorption lines, although it's not ideal because there are peculiar velocities as well, which I haven't shown here. And basically, by specifying the density field, the peculiar velocity, the temperature, and the ionization state of the gas, we have a complete information about the appearance as Lyman alpha absorption. This is inherent in the Gunn-Peterson effect formula, which is the only formula you have to remember in the whole subject here, that the optical depth for Lyman alpha absorption is given by these quantities. It's actually very simple. This is a neutral fraction of the gas, omega baryon squared divided by the photoionization rate. There is recombination coefficient, which is temperature dependent, and there is the local density field. So if the density goes up, the optical depth goes up. If the temperature goes up, it actually goes down, becomes more ionized, and so on. And there's a term that accounts for peculiar velocities. Now, people have begun doing cosmology with this, which is actually not the topic of this meeting, but I just mentioned this here. One of the things you can do is you can measure the neutral fraction, which is proportional to the optical depth, and that's proportional to the omega baryon squared over J. And here's an example of what happens if you increase the omega baryon by 17%, then the spectrum becomes stronger, they have more absorption, and it's actually relatively sensitive to the baryon fraction. So in principle, you can measure omega baryon if you have a reasonable idea of the radiation background. Now, is this picture right? What's the observation evidence in favor of the paradigm? And the first evidence that came forth was the size of Lyman alpha clouds. The way to attack this is to observe pairs of quasars and to look for common absorption along the lines of sight. A typical separation that is useful here is about 200 kiloparsecs proper beam separation. And you do the hit and miss statistics. You look for absorption lines that are in the other image or not in the other image, and from binomial distribution of that and the suitable model of the cloud, you get typical cloud sizes. And this is extremely primitive, in fact, but it gives you an idea of the scales involved. And here's a computation by Krotz and Fang of the measurements done up to 1998. And here's the radius of spherical clouds assumed versus beam separation. That's not so interesting. But you see that these measurements all hover around 400, 500 kiloparsecs. So these things are really as huge as you see them in the simulation. So that was an important clue. Another clue came from the column density distribution, which is nicely reproduced by the simulation. This is a data set, the red points by Petitjean et al. And this is one of the simulations, the one by Matthias, showing the column density distribution function, which is the number of clouds in a given column density bin per unit redshift. So that comes out nicely. People have given analytical arguments why it should be so. Another example is the statistical distribution of fluxes. So if you write down a histogram of the fluxes in the spectrum, just pixel by pixel, you'll get something like this. It's a cumulative distribution versus the absorbed flux. Absorbed flux goes from 0 to 1, obviously. And the solid line is from 8 quasar spectra from Keck high-res for different redshift bins, mean redshift 2, 3, and 4. And the dotted line is from Chen's lambda CDM simulation. You find extremely good agreement after scaling them to the same area under the curve. The area under the curve is the omega baryon squared over J. So once you agree on the same omega baryon, on the right omega baryon, this is your free parameter, you get the shape automatically. And that's actually a very good confirmation of hierarchical structure formation, because there's no reason why this shape should come out like this. Then there is this was a one-point function. This is now it comes to two-point correlation function. There is an approach that was pioneered by Croft, Weinberg, Katz, and Turnquist, and collaborators, that you can actually go directly from your fluctuations in the flux spectrum to the mass power spectrum. And here's a similar approach where you compare two flux power spectra to each other. This is by McDonald and Miralda Escudé. And again, the data are these seven quasars, the crosses, and the solid line is the simulation. And you see excellent agreement down to here. And here's a problem with the window function. You have to cut out metals, and the line profiles are not exactly right. But on larger scales, there's excellent agreement. So the fluctuation power and the fluctuation amplitude seem to agree. It can be made to agree within reasonable cosmological parameters. Now, of course, there's one nagging question, that is the simulations all have limited resolution. So how clumpy is the intergalactic medium really on smaller scales? The clumpiness could destroy all your conclusions, because you could hide more or less omega baryon, actually less omega baryon, for a given absorption in the forest, and that would be very upsetting. Now, the way to test this is, to run some very close lines of sight of order a few hundred kilo, a few hundred parsecs, just below the resolution limit, the resolution of typically a few kiloparsecs, through the line alpha force, and look whether you can see differences, where you see a smooth intergalactic medium, in which case you would have identical absorption lines, where you see clumpiness, in which case you don't have to agree at all. You could also detect cosmic explosions like supernovae along the line of sight this way. So you can measure either the density gradient across or the velocity shear between the two lines of sight. We've done this for a number of quasars. Here's an example how it actually, this is the best, the most impressive example. This is the Hakra et al, a quadruple lens, which this is a lensing galaxy, and here's absorption by another galaxy that is at much higher redshift behind it. And you see very different absorption systems. I'll get to that later. It's just a metal system.
Can you show that again?
This magnesium 2 absorption at redshift 0.5, and this is at redshift 0, effectively, this galaxy. So. I can draw conclusions as to the size of magnesium 2, because I know the beam separation. I don't want to go into this now, because it's metal systems, but I just show you the Land Alpha Forest. Now, we can talk about this. I have plenty of material about this. Here's the Land Alpha Forest of, again, 1422, everybody's favorite quasar. And we've taken two images with a beam separation of 1.3 arc seconds, and the mean spatial separation, transverse, in proper coordinates is 200 parsecs between the two beams. And the A image is black underneath, the C image is red. It's just a convention, name convention. And you see there's no difference except for a few cases here, for example, and here, and here, and here. You see there's a line missing, actually. And that tells you immediately that the lambda alpha forest on these cases is totally smooth. And okay, I don't know to show you more, but I'll show you a few metal lines which are at higher column density which look very different. So here's a very strong carbon-4 system that you can see the doublet pattern. So there's no doubt this is not noise. It's a real difference. Here's another line that is, I think this is iron of one system. Here's actually the only line, alpha forest lines we've seen in three quasar that is shifted, where the actual Lyman line is shifted. And this is very close to the quasar emission line. You see it peaking here. It's probably gas that has been expelled by the quasar. It also has very, very high ionization, as you can tell from some other metal lines. But that's the only exception in the Lyman alpha forest among hydrogen lines that we've actually found where something is different. One of them is a damped system. It's a metal line of a damped system, and they look very different over these separations. Okay, the results are, I just mentioned this very quickly, that you can translate the differences or absence of differences in the column density between the two lines of sight into differences in baryon density, because for low column density clouds, there is a relatively tight relation between these two quantities, and then the flicker in or the absence of the flicker in column density translates into an upper limit on the flicker in the baryon density. And this is a very small value. It's only 2% over 170 parsecs. And similarly, the velocity gradients are non-existent. This is within the error of 3.4 kilometers per second. Okay, why is it so quiescent? I think the answer is actually gas pressure. But you may disagree with this. What you can do is you can look at the spectrum and you find that about 92% of the spectrum has changes in optical depth of less than 10%. And you can translate this value into an upper limit on the number of disturbances that may have occurred in a given time along the line of sight. And imagine you had supernova going off close to these double lines of sight. Then the supernova passes the two lines of sight and destroys the absorption pattern. So you know something has happened. But the sound speed will send a pressure wave across these lines in a time scale that is given by the separation divided by the sound speed. It will basically re-establish pressure equilibrium by a multiple of this time scale. So in this case, with a separation of 110 parsecs and the sound speed of 20 kilometers per second, after 6 million years, they should have equilibrated again. And so in principle, you could use this as a cosmic seismometer. You could measure the rate of supernova along the line of sight. I mean, it's probably not so interesting because it's supernova in intergalactic space, but you can do the same for metal systems, for instance, just a little bit harder for various reasons. So the fraction of the spectrum that's undisturbed is related to the density, the rate of explosions of these disturbances, whatever they are. Very, very simple covering factor argument, and this gives you a supernova upper limit of 10 to the 4 per cubic megaparsec per giga year under certain assumptions. Anyway, this is an idea that has to be explored. It's just an example of what you can actually do with this. So our conclusion is that the Lyman alpha forest is really featureless on sub-kiloparsec scales. Now, don't talk about cosmological tests. There are lots of. I refer you to the talks by Martin Handel, by Lam Hui, and David Weinberg. Just summarize this part. And so Lyman alpha clouds are large, on the order of 1 megaparsec. They're smooth over sub-kiloparsec scales. They have low density, down to underdense regions, of course. They're highly ionized, 10 to the minus 5, typically. And they're warm a few times, 10 to the 4 degrees to a few thousand degrees. The hierarchical models work amazingly well. You can compare various quantities, omega baryon, the 1-point, 2-point function, the line width. And in fact, aside from the cosmic microwave background, it's possibly the best evidence we have that some sort of hierarchical structure formation must be at work. Most baryons are probably in low-density clouds. Then we have cosmological applications, which I couldn't go into, related to large-scale structure and the thermal history of the universe. But there's one caveat. This is that the large fraction of the intergalactic medium that fills the filaments is actually metal-enriched. And this may upset the thermal history, the bulk motion of the gas, and the temperature. I just want to say a little bit more about this. So if you go into these higher density filaments, you find carbon-4 systems. This is the most common observational manifestation. You have, I've mentioned this again, widespread metal enrichment with a covering factor of about 50% down to 10 to the 14.5. And this may actually include a third of all baryons. So that's quite an amazing finding. The metallicity is generally low with a large scatter. The metal systems, you have seen that already. Okay. The metal systems are strongly clustered. There's a two-point correlation function for carbon-4. It dips only below 400 kilometers per second. Ignore this dotted line, it's the histogram beneath. The temperature of the gas is around a few times 10 to the 4 degrees, and interestingly, the bulk motion is very small. Here's a diagram of total carbon-4 Doppler parameter versus thermal Doppler parameter, and you can actually split this by observing another ion and another ion with a different mass and divide the bulk motion out. And the bulk motion in carbon-4 components is typically less than about 10 kilometers per second. Here are lines of equal bulk motion, and here's a 10 kilometers per second line coming down. And most of the points are indicating that it's even less. Maybe this is a line where it's zero. So this gas is very quiescent. The small scale structure is very different, as you can see when you run, again, these closed quasar lines of sight through them. Here's, again, Matthias' simulation where I've just indicated how this would look like. You have several proto-galaxies. All of these are actually falling together to form a single one at low redshift. And these have speeds of about 200 kilometers per second along the line of sight. So it's easily imaginable that this is the source of the wide velocity widths of carbon-4 systems. I mean, the Hubble constant times the size of this box gives you 400 kilometers per second between here and here already. And you may have infall as well. Okay, then how do the metal systems look like? I showed you one plot already. Here's another one. Fix your eyes on this one. This is a carbon-4 system of enormous width, 400 kilometers per second again. Here's a blow-up of the region. Oops. You recognize that there is a... Ignore the pattern to the right of this. It's just a repetition of this one with the lower oscillator strength. So there's one block here that is shifted by about 30 kilometers per second relative to the underlying line of sight. There's another bit here that's almost at the same velocity position in both lines of sight, and that we would interpret as two proto-galaxies, that one of them is possibly rotating. This is where the shear comes from. It's actually a shear, not a shift. And this other one is not rotating. It's just sitting there, giving the same appearance in both lines of sight. And the large velocity structure comes from either from infall of these clumps onto each other, or because you're looking along a filament and see the Hubble expansion. Now, I've plotted here some of the results of these double line of sight studies. What we're measuring is simply how much do two carbon-4 systems differ in column density. This is red area in two lines of sight, so NA minus NB divided by the max of the two. And you can measure the difference in velocity if you want, so it's column density divided velocity between these two systems, and try to match this with some astrophysical environment we may know. And at the bottom you see the statistic for different classes of carbon-4 systems. The whole carbon-4 system, which I've denoted here as complex, is given by these big circles. So I've plotted the fractional change in column density, this quantity between the two lines of sight for carbon-4 systems versus the transverse beam separation. And this is here, 10 kiloparsecs, 1 kiloparsec, 100 parsec, 10 parsec, and so on. And you see that at about 300 parsecs, the things suddenly begin to blow up. There's a large scatter, obviously, but there's something going on within the first kiloparsec of separation. And that, if you interpret this as the size of the clouds, it tells you that the 40 or 50% changes occur at 300 parsecs, and that's about the coherence length of carbon-4 systems. So there's nothing underneath. They're very quiescent, down to a few percent. Okay, two more minutes. Okay, what does it mean? Yeah, one more transparency. Where do carbon-4 systems arise? I mentioned it already, it's probably in the outskirts of filaments, but to show you that this is not just a mistaken galactic environment, I've plotted here the internal velocity turbulence versus the size of H2 regions and giant extragalactic H2 regions and molecular clouds from compilation by Odell. And the carbon-4 systems fall in a very strange place and fall on the locus of molecular clouds, which is an accident, I guess. But what it tells you is that they're much more quiescent for a given size than any galactic environment that has a similar ionization stage. So these things cannot be residing in potential wells or in the disks of galaxies. Okay, let me put on summary of this part. For the higher column densities, we know that they're metal polluted, they are residing in filaments, they still have much lower density than the virial density of a galaxy. They're quiescent, they're homogeneous, so there's no stellar wind or supernova going off in the vicinity of them. And the velocity structure on larger scales is characteristic of expanding filaments or mergers, but less so of galactic halos. And the origin of metals is unclear. There may be population 3 enriched gas that is on its first infall onto the specific object, or there may be outflows or winds which are gradually returning back to the galaxy. That's it.
Michael, you interpret all the variations in absorption depth as due to column density variations of baryons. How do you know that there aren't significant variations due to the ionization field changing from place to place?
We don't know, but something that produces ionization gradients over these small scales also produce density or velocity variations. Imagine there's a hot star going on.
Well, I mean, you're talking kiloparsec scales, and a significant amount of the ionization is recombination to ground state. That is density dependent, so within these clouds you'd expect some variation in that radiation field. I think it's something it might be worried about a little bit.
Just a very mild comment, Michael. Wouldn't it be rather difficult to do this without blowing winds, given how quiescent the systems are?
Well, I agree. No, but it must be far away from the source of the wind. These winds are expanding, they're rising a high density gas.
No, but you need to blow the material presumably out to the location where it's at, right? So, I mean, you need to transfer it out with some kinematic structure. And, you know, while you could imagine that the crossing time is sufficiently long that in fact the velocity might not actually violate your 10 kilometers a second velocity, you still probably can't blow things out at 10 kilometers a second. You need to blow them out faster than that, surely. I mean, and then you get into problems with your other observations essentially.
I wanted to ask you this business about being very far from the galactic potential. Well, are these preferentially the carbon-4 systems that have low column densities? Because we know that a lot of the magnesium-2 systems also exhibit carbon-4 absorption, and they are associated with... I'm sorry? But these are optically thin. Okay, that's what I want. No, I don't mean damn lemon elf. I just meant magnesium-2 systems that have carbon-4, and they're definitely associated with potential wells.
Yeah.
So you do mean the optically thin. Okay.